Good evening, everybody. May 11th, 2017, James McKenna here with my Science Hour. For this week, my main science topic, I'll be continuing from where I left off last week, talking about moons in the solar system and electrical conditions around those moons, and especially rings. Where do these rings come from? Where do they go? And so my topic is called Rings and Snowflakes. Now, also, can you imagine a ring of diamonds? Now, I talked about this before in my show, but we have many different types of rings. We have a sulfur dioxide ring around Jupiter. We have water rings around Saturn. And we have diamond rings around other stars. Possibly there's some in our own solar system. It's a very good possibility. First of all, wow, this in Hanford, Washington, just, 2 days ago now, a tunnel, or the ceiling of a tunnel collapsed, fell in, and this is where they store nuclear fuel and nuclear waste. It's not real clear what all is in the tunnel, but this is a site that's been active since World War II. It's one of the World War II original sites. It's the first location, I believe, for a nuclear reactor for so-called peaceful purposes in the United States. It was used as a breeder reactor. And just listen to this. During World War II, when they got done processing the uranium up there, then the uranium, by the way, was coming from no other place than Oregon. They would take the uranium out and spread it in the fields like, kind of like a farmer would do with cow manure back in the old days when we had real organic farming, and the farmer would take the cow manure from the barn. They would clean the barn, and I've been part of this process, so I very, very boots on the ground familiar with this. So they would go out, and there was a trough behind where all the cows were, and you would clean that out and make a big pile out of it. And then you would have this called the spreader. That was the machine, which had belts in it, kind of like steel belts, kind of like snowmobile belts. And then this kind of like these teeth that swirled around and threw the cow stuff all over the field. And then in the spring, that would be fertilizer for the corn. And it also did something, by the way, this is part of organic farming, that it controlled the pests, because the pests didn't like that environment probably any more than you might. So anyway, there was a kind of a method to the madness. Anyway, how did I get off on that topic? But I don't know if it was the military, the U.S., or who was in charge of this, the federal whoever, went out and spread the uranium trailings after the processing, because you never get 100% of it out of any kind of extraction process. You never get 100%. And that last 1% to 5% is very expensive to get out. So you just, you leave it in a big pile someplace. But what they did is they went out and they spread it all over in Oregon. And so on these big plain areas in Oregon, and that's, by the way, where they want to mine uranium now. And that's why they were kicking these people off their ranches up there. It was Hillary Clinton was selling the uranium rights to Russia through a backdoor deal through a company, Canadian company called Uranium One, giving money to the Clinton Foundation for her while she was Secretary of State to approve the uranium sales. Okay, so anyway, that's another story. But anyway, Hanford, Washington, you can see it's on the map. And it was basically one of the, St. Louis was another place where they processed the uranium for the Manhattan Project, which of course was to build nuclear bombs to, race with the Germans during World War II. But Hanford, Washington has been a nuclear waste site since World War II. They store heavy water there. It's one of the few places in the United States where they store heavy water. The heavy water comes out of the nuclear reactors and is part of the process for shutting down the reaction process or controlling it. And so, of course, it's highly radioactive when it comes out. Now, it's not listed as high radioactive, material, but they have to store it. And if you remember, it was within a year ago, Hanford was where they had a breached tank, one of these holding tanks for the heavy water that is used in nuclear reactors. One of them breached, and it's like a thermos jar that you use for coffee. But it's a double wall, kind of like thermal container where they contain this. And I don't know what they're thinking, if this is going to last forever and ever. Well, of course not. Nothing is going to last forever and ever. But at any rate, back to the original issue 2 days ago, that was announced. They closed off the area, sealed it, cordoned it off, and it's no longer available, and nobody can go there. That's the last I've heard. So we don't really know much about it. They are saying that there was no atmospheric release. The people of Hanford, you know, like I say, it's really not clear from the news stories what's going on there. But they're not letting anybody back to this site. But essentially what happened is the roof of this tunnel, and from the story I read, I don't have a reporter on the ground there, but it was like a 20 by 20 hole just in the top of this tunnel, but that just fell in. And so is that due to poor structure? Was there some kind of event that happened there? We don't know. Nobody's talking. It's like the San Onofre plant over in San Diego, just north of San Diego, the big, big mega nuclear power plant that just shut down one day. Nobody seems to mention much about it. Gee, just a brand new, you know, multi-billion dollar nuclear power plant that just one day shut down. Interesting. But so I really don't have much to report about Hanford, Washington, other than it happened. I'll certainly try and keep some, you know, ear to the rail on this and report it on my webpage if I get more information. This week, a listener wrote in and asked the following question about water filters. If you have a water filter and you use it past its designated lifetime, then can the toxins that it traps somehow get back into the water? And that's a good question. I've talked a little bit about this. For example, we have, let me just divide this industry into kind of two divisions here. We have the high pressure systems, like the inline, that's where you have your water line with pressure in it, goes through the filter. There's the inline pressurized on-demand water filters. I sell those. You know, they're available on the market in general. And then there's the gravity-fed, which is a slow process. And one of the questions I answered before was, will radiation, can you trap radiation in one of these systems? And the end result is that, say, for example, with my filters, the radiation is trapped. It's in the heavy metal category. And so it's trapped in the absorber part in the middle of the filter. And most of it, however, radiation is trapped on the outside because radiation likes to attach itself to dust and dirt particles. And it's a very loose bonding. It's not like a covalent bond with atoms. It's just a very loose bonding. And so the point is that the radiation can break free and flow into your filter. And if nothing else, it contaminates it. But the pressurized system, you may trap the radiation in the dust particle it's attached to, but eventually that radiation particle under the pressure is going to break free and flow into your water filter and maybe get all the way through because it's under pressure. So radiation is kind of a special case. But in general, say you're trapping volatile organic chemicals, or say you're trapping something else, could those get back into your water system? And this is one of the tests that I do with my filters, is to actually test the lifetime of the filter. And one of the tests is to make sure that nothing that is trapped by the filter, or that is a part of the filter, comes through the filter and into your water. So the filter is stopping things from getting through, But obviously, it's the filter. It's going to become contaminated with whatever is in your water. And then hopefully your water comes through without any impurities in it, just the minerals that are good for you or to your, for your plants or animals or whatever you're filtering the water for. So but the end result is that I'm not sure why you would want to use a filter over its rated lifetime, especially if you have chemicals, you know, arsenic, fluoride, chloramines, glyphosates, etc. And by the way, there's many, many false claims. I'm just hearing so many false claims on the radio these days or on the advertisements, printed advertisements, etc. But anyway, I'm not going to go into that now. But the question was, should you use a filter past its lifetime? And the answer is, like many of those answers, it depends. Now, I've given filters away down in the tropics. I gave some filters away to various people, poor people, and they literally used containers, plastic containers where that food had come in. Drill a hole in, you put one of my filters in there, and I came back many years later. They're still using the same filter, just one of them. They've been cleaning it. Looks like they've cleaned it about 200 times, which they had. And so it's almost deformed. They've cleaned it so many times, but it's still working. And it's still protecting them because all there is silt in the water. And, you know, that's all they're trying to get out. They don't have chemicals. They don't have fluoride or arsenic or any of those other chemicals. So they're fine. They're fine doing that. But if you're taking materials out, there's two parts of filtration in my filters anyway. You have the filter, which is on the outside, the ceramic, and that's a true filter with a small pore size, half micron, and the particles are trapped outside of that. But then there's some particles that are smaller, they're in solution, and that's where the inner filtration part comes from to take those out. That can be used up, the inner part can be used up, and it's not cleanable. So you could literally, you know, go past the lifetime, which we say is, for my standard filters, about 1,000 gallons. For the Imperials, you know, a number of thousands of gallons, maybe 3,000 gallons. But then, yeah, if you have serious chemical problems or if you're sitting in a city, then you certainly want to change them out after you've used that amount of water per filter element. Anyway, that in from a listener. Whatever happened to my Windroids project? A listener wrote in, and I get people asking me about this. First of all, the fundraiser was pretty much a flop. It did not succeed. It was quite a while ago. And if I could have developed this at the time, it would have been a viable product. But here's what has happened in the meantime. And the reason I call this Windroids 11 OS, because Windows 10 was just coming in at the time, so that's where the wind part comes from, the wind part. And then there's Roids for Androids, so the D-Roid kind of combines the two. It's kind of the glue of the two words. So it's Windroid, so it's a combination of Windroid, of Windows and Android. So it's Windroids 11, so 11 being one after 10, and then operating system OS, Windroids 11 OS. Whatever happened to this? Well, it turns out that the NSA, the CIA, etc., the people that have their hand on top of manufacturing firms that make telephones, tablets, PCs, whatever, have moved from the operating system before their hooks were in above the operating system in malware, you might call it, which you might be able to search for and find. Then they went down into the operating system, and at that point, I was going to replace the operating system with a look-alike. I mean, it would act and feel and do all the same things as Windows and Android systems, but it would block, it would give you control of your phone. Well, now the CIA, NSA, etc., have gone down into the firmware, which is micro-coded hardware, that's another name for that, and the hardware level right in the phone. So literally, no matter what you do, you're going to be trapped in their web, let's put it that way. And today, a good deal, or I would say the majority of traffic on the internet, whether it's voice or data or whatever, is trapped in the telcos and in the hooks that the NSA, CIA have in the telecommunication system. So, and by the way, there's no secure encryption systems out there. One of the rules, if you're building encryption systems, is you have to let the CIA, NSA have the hooks into those so that they can tap into your phone conversation or whatever. So literally, there is no such thing as a safe haven, a safe place to go in terms of telephone, tablet, telecommunications, or whatever. And John, excuse me, John McAfee, by the way, who have a great deal of respect for, he had a company, ran for president. He was, a presidential candidate. And he had a company still, I believe, I don't know if he's still the owner of the company, McAfee, antivirus, etc. So he's a guy that's been in that industry from a different perspective than me. My 25 years in the telecom industry was a bit different, but I was in the design hardware aspect of telecommunications at the major computer level, at the level that international banks and Shell Oil and companies like that would be at. That's where I was located. And then also large companies that managed telecommunication networks. So those were the two places I was for 25 years of my life. All of the time working in the background on my science stuff, doing all of the things I do, including breaking the RSA codes, the prime number problem. But McAfee said that he had invented a phone, he's marketing it, which he says is hack-proof. And what he's doing is apparently there's a switch which disconnects the antenna, the GPS communications, and other aspects of your phone. And so that's nice. So if you turn this switch, then your phone, well, it won't work because you've disconnected all the input and output signaling. But it's kind of like putting a Faraday cage around your phone so that nothing can get in or out. But eventually, when you have to switch all that back on so you can use your phone, they could set it up so that the phone is tracking all your information. And believe me, if there's a device, they have a way that they can get in there, send a signal in or whatever, and get into your phone and control it. So, I mean, it's an okay concept, but ultimately, there's no getting out of the matrix. Let's just put it that way. As I said, the majority of trapping of information is not in your phone itself. That's just a way to garner information from inside your phone and have it sent out. But the majority of your trapping of hacking, if you want to call it that, or eavesdropping, is done in the telcos. When your message or your information has left your phone and identifies you and where you're at and everything else that goes with it. But he does have a good point in saying that the towers, the imitation towers that are sitting there that can interrupt and intercept your telephone call, he has a way of blocking that from happening. So anyway, I'm not saying I'm not talking against the product. I'm just saying that it's like he who lives by the sword dies by the sword, or spy versus spy or whatever. No matter what you create in 6 months, just like I was going to do Windroid's 11 OS, in 6 months, they've already bypassed what you've done and are off and running in, beyond what you're doing. Okay, a little comment. There's a comet called Johnson that's in view right now, binocular viewable. And there's probably about five others. So if you're a comet watcher with binoculars, Comet Johnson, you can look up the orbit, the tracking across the sky, all available. But it's an interesting comet in that it's green. Once again, we have a green comet. And standard science says that a green comet is due to the light reflecting off the carbon dioxide. Now, boys and girls, I would challenge anybody in the media or in this NASA or whatever, whoever is putting out this totally false narrative, to go into a laboratory, take your CO2 glass tubes. This is not hard to do. And, you know, it's a sealed glass tube like a neon light with CO2 in it. And it has electrodes at the end. And shine a light. Get as powerful a light as you can find, you know, a mercury vapor lamp or a laser. Shine it through that glass tube of CO2 and see how much light is given off by the CO2. Well, you know, you're not going to see anything. That's the bottom light. The light you shine on it is going to go right through, and it's not going to make it visible from a distance. The CO2 you're seeing from a distance is because of the electron beam that's passing through that region of the comet, and it's exciting the carbon dioxide atoms to fluoresce. That means an electron goes up in state, drops down, and that's where you get the fluorescence in outer space. Now, if you take that same tube in the laboratory, you take and you put a high voltage across the electrodes at the end of the tube, and you put electric current through there, you will get a nice bright light. But it takes an electric current to do that. So anyway, just more fairy tale science trying to explain why these comets are green. And of course, my comet model, as with all of these details, predicts and explains why comets look green when we have a carbon dioxide atmosphere. Or if you happen to be around Jupiter and the comets all of a sudden turn out to be sulfur dioxide comets, then they turn red. That's because sulfur dioxide characteristic color is it's kind of an orangish color. I wouldn't say pure red. Anyway, but we have I wouldn't say it's naked eye visible, but with binoculars. So if you're a person with binoculars, small telescope, maybe go out and track this. And it does have a characteristic plasma tail. It's quite visible on this comet, so that's very interesting. It's got its dust tail, the broad, what we would call the comet tail. And then there's a fine plasma tail, which is a term that's used in standard astronomy. But that's due to the electron beam, which continues on after it passes by the comet. It charges up the comet nucleus to a negative potential, but then it continues on and causing the CO2 to fluoresce beyond on the anti-sunward side of the comet. Okay. Announcement, and this, for me, it's very difficult to make the following announcement. A good friend of mine, and I've talked about him before in my show, I've interviewed this guy on my show before. He's a part of my MP3 lecture series CD set, the 2-CD set, 18 hours of lectures, and the name of that lecture set is The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. Warner Sizemore passed away about 2 weeks ago. I didn't say anything immediately on my show, but Warner was a good friend of mine for going back to the early 1980s is when we first had communication. And I never really talked to him a lot because he was more in official capacity on a journal called Kronos. Now, Kronos was the main editor, a guy named Louis Greenberg, a person that worked diligently, a master editor, and never got really enough credit for all of the amazing work that he did with a journal called Kronos. And Warner was associated with that journal also, but Warner Sizemore was the personal secretary to Emanuel Velikovsky. So here is a guy that was with Velikovsky literally every day for decades and was in the background. He kept the records. He recorded the conferences that Velikovsky went to. meticulously cataloged things, was there when Velikovsky published some of his later books, especially the books on Saturn, etc. Werner Sizemore was there. He was there at the Velikovsky house when Albert Einstein used to come over. And I talked with Werner extensively about this. There's an effort afoot in the, I don't know it's what's causing this or what the, I have some theories, but there are some groups that are trying to slam Einstein. And I can tell you from studying physics, from being a historian of physics, that Albert Einstein was a very unique scientist. He did some very unique physics that, in fact, in my Paidcast, I have, my Paidcast series, I have Tesla versus Einstein, a couple episodes of that. In there, I discuss the science of Einstein and what he did, and et cetera, so I'm not going to repeat it here. I recommend you go listen to those. But Einstein was at Princeton, Velikovsky was at Princeton, Werner Sizemore was at Princeton. And Werner Sizemore was literally there every day. He was there for the phone calls, were there for understanding who was who, etc. But I interviewed Warren on my show. And then I took his 2 hours of interview and I put them on my CD because I knew that someday Werner would not be with us. And he was older. He had a marvelous career. But I knew that, you know, like, well, I guess like everybody, someday he wouldn't be here. And a man of that value really had to be interviewed. So I interviewed him. It's on my 2-CD set. I recommend that you go listen to that. It's the 2-CD, it's a 18-hour MP3 lecture, 2-CD set, The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. And of course, a big part of this and understanding this whole area is Velikovsky. So since Velikovsky wasn't around, I interviewed Werner Sizemore. And anyway, I highly recommend that you go listen to those. But so many people in that field, we never really got to know in the public. You know, I was fortunate because of my position in the science world, the work that I did with the comet theory, my 3-part comet paper, which is in the appendix of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, is a summary that was taken out of a 350-page book that I wrote when I was at Cornell University, dealing with comet capture processes in the formation of solar system. That was the title. And so the 3-part comet paper, which was a summary of that work, goes all through the comet theory, the plasma discharge comet model, the solar wind, the discharge of the solar capacitor, the equations that and the importance of charge to mass ratio, the pinch effect, fusion on Jupiter and Saturn, and the induced electric dipole redshift, the fact that fusion is in the atmosphere of stars, Jupiter, Saturn, our small unlit stars, and on, the whole laundry list of topics. But Werner was an editor on that, on the staff of Kronos. And so Kronos picked that up, and we went through a lot of basically boiling down the book to get it into a form that, and it was published in 3 different issues of Kronos. And so that's what you see, and it was definitely a peer-reviewed journal, and it was a very laborious, that's when editing was editing. It was, there were no computers, it was typed, and you know, by hand, basically, and then passed, sent back and forth in the mail, etc. But Werner, you know, was an integral part of that whole process. But being the secretary of Velikovsky, very, very, very important. And I always have to say this, remind people that when I was at Cornell doing my theoretical work, the data was coming in, all of that, I didn't know any of these people. I didn't know who Velikovsky was because I had been out of the country for about 10 years. I had been not in the United States. doing some other basic research, I guess you would call it. And so when I got to Cornell, I had all of my theoretical work in place, the electromagnetic conditions in the solar system, etc. And then I did my stint at Cornell, and of course, that's all history, you all know about that. And then afterwards, I was looking for a place to continue publishing because I had been blackballed from the standard astrophysics journals because I was successfully publishing and they didn't want to see that anymore. So at any rate, I found the journal Kronos, and it was dedicated to supporters of Velikovsky. And people were fishing around for answers, and what I came along with was I didn't know these people previous to that. But what I came along with was really a composite theory that didn't just cover comets. It was how the sun worked, the corona of the sun. I mean, the solar wind, which even to this day, they don't have a good explanation for how the solar wind works or why there's a solar corona of relativistic electrons around the sun. I had all that nailed down back then. And so anyway, it was a great boon for me to get this published and show on record all of my accomplishments at that time when it actually happened. And so Warner was instrumental in that. So in a sense, we go way, way back. That was in the early 1980s. And a lot of you weren't even born then. Good grief. And so I continued with my scientific career and then reconnected with Warner, many times during that off and on. But then I realized, this was when I was doing my show, I already had my radio show, and so I said, I got to interview Warner Sizemore. And a few weeks ago, I got word that he had passed away. So I tell you, I was on a radio show just the other day. I was on Tim Spencer's show. A woman called in, and she was talking about water filters, and she says, by the way, and she mentioned the name of a guy who I communicated with for a long time, maybe a decade, on a regular basis about everything going on in the what you might call alternative media world. And there's another guy that passed away, or my good friend Brad Walton, radio host from Minneapolis. I was on his show many times, introduced many of my books with Brad Walton, a good friend, and passed away. So it's like, it's getting kind of thin out here. Other people are having health issues. All I can tell you is that I'm doing very well health-wise. I'm at the top of my game. I'm busier than ever with projects in my work and theoretical work on 10 different subjects. But along the way, there are people that were big helps that made major contributions to help me out because, and Warner Sizemore was one of those people. That's what I'm trying to say. Very sorely missed. I hadn't talked to him a while. I know he had failing health, so I tried to not really communicate. The last few times I talked to Warner, I could tell he was not doing very well. And got the word a couple weeks ago that he had passed away. So Warner Sizemore, a piece of history passing on, but not forgotten. Believe me, not forgotten. I want to add this little thought also, that when you see the enormous fame of somebody like Carl Sagan, who demolished Velikovsky and got tremendous personal gain for doing that, and then you find people like Warner Sizemore working every day diligently, doing his due diligence, Velikovsky, and the unbridled fame that comes to a guy like Sagan. And this is one reason I'm doing my paid cast series, the Cosmos series, because I want to expose Sagan for what he is. He was a scientist in standard science, literally tier two science, who really was not a very good scientist. He was a spokesman for the astronomy community who desperately needed recognition and notoriety. But They developed their theories long before spacecraft really went out and searched the great unknown out there. And so that's why I'm taking Sagan to task right now, because literally on all of the fronts we have to talk about, I'm the only person on the planet that have been there. I was at Cornell when Sagan was there and when he was doing the Cosmos series. So I was nose to nose with all of this. And of course, Carl Sagan has passed away. He's not with us anymore. So it's important to understand that a lot of these people like Warner Sizemore or Velikovsky, of course, Velikovsky was famous for his own right, but a lot of these people in the background were not famous because someone like Sagan, you know, took all the fame and not righteously. And I should take a minute to thank also my guardian angels. I really don't know how many I have. I've determined that I must have at least 10 to manage and keep me pointed in the right direction and to guide me so that I've gotten this far in life without, with all of the, let's say, the thorn in the side that I've been to the standard community and the world government and the banks and everything else. You know, I've definitely have a large consortium, a Congress of angels hovering over me. And I don't go into a lot of detail about some of these, let's say, sticky situations I've been in my life. And I don't really go into a lot of the detail, but many, many, many times over, I've had situations where it looked like the end was staring me in the face. And all I can tell you is that, like I say, there were angels. There had to be about at least a dozen flapping their wings and helping out. And I'm trying to live a very conservative lifestyle now because hopefully I can live for a lot longer. We never know. I could slip on a banana peel tomorrow. But I have a lot of work to do yet. I've done a lot. I have a lot yet to do. And the future for me is very bright. There's a lot going on and I have a lot to accomplish yet. So anyway, but once again, thanks for people like Warner Sizemore, my, you know, Congress of Angels that are helping me out all the time, pushing me in the right direction, keeping me from going in the wrong direction, etc. Just a quick mention about my paid cast this week. Let me first mention next week I'll be talking about the topic. I had bumped it from last month. It's the monthly Tesla's Mind episode next week in the paid cast, Coils and Schmidt Triggers. Now, these are very important parts of any Tesla device. So I wanted to take these devices out of their collective inventions and explain them to you, resonant coils, coupled coils, transformers, and Tesla coil is a common term, but what is a Tesla coil? How does it work? And, you know, high voltage, high frequency, Schmidt triggers are an essential part of this. So that's next week's paid cast. I encourage you to listen to these. This week's paid cast is a barn burner. I will be talking about the history of man, something I do a lot, but I'm going to be talking about the Sumerian tablets, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Who was Gilgamesh? What did this have to do with history? Where do the Sumerians fit into history? How about the Venus event, the Great Flood, the Phoenicians, the Mayas, the pre-Incas, the Colburn, all of these in the show that is associated with this week on the paid cast. And so what I'm attempting to do is put a lot of this into historical context because, and for a lot of people, these are pieces that have no relationship. Well, they're all very related. I'll be going through that on this week's paid cast. And it's part of the Cosmos series, by the way. And the reason I'm doing this is because Sagan and the boys deny all of this, deny the biggest parts of the history of man. So anyway, listen in this week on the paid cast. If you're not a member, go to the webpage, $3.95 a month, less than a cup of coffee. For this kind of information, you will not find any place else. On to the main science topic. Okay. Rings in the solar system. First of all, let's take a little solar system tour and discuss where these rings are. The sun has a ring, for starters. It's called the zodiacal light. Some people call it zodiacal, but believe me, I understand Greek and Latin, and it's zodiacal light is the way it's pronounced. The zodiacal light is primarily iron. It's a belt of iron that circles the sun, and on 2 days of the year, now you can imagine the sun with this like Saturn-like ring around it of iron, and as we pass through the plane of this ring of iron around the sun, you can see the sunlight reflecting off of it, and it looks like a kind of a line sticking up off the horizon in the morning and then in the evening at certain times of the year. So you can look this up and see when the dates are. And if you have clear viewing and you have a good view after, now don't look at the sun with your eyes. Don't use binoculars to look at the sun or any kind of optical device. You wait till the sun is down, or if it's sunrise, you wait, you look before the sun comes up. And on those particular dates, if you're lucky, you can see the zodiacal light. It's just a band. It's a reflection off this ring of material around the sun. Mercury does not have a ring system. Venus has a comet tail, but not a ring. Earth, in a sense, we have rings. We have the Van Allen belts, but they're not visible. They're primarily protons and electrons, and anything with a higher mass is not going to be trapped that close to the Earth's magnetic field. There would be probably some other characteristic materials in the region trapped in our magnetic field, but in a sense, these are not rings like the rings of Saturn. That's a different mechanism. The Van Allen belts, which are around Earth, are more like, kind of, they look more like donuts if you could see them. And what happens is the high energy particles coming in from the sun come in and they break through the magnetic field because they're coming at higher velocity. They break through our protective magnetic field, which is probably about 30,000 miles out to the sunward side of Earth. They break through and they become trapped in a cyclotron type of radiation pattern around Earth. The electrons go one way, the protons go the other way. And because the protons are more massive, they exist in a belt that's farther out. And so at any rate, that's the Van Allen belt. So it's a different process than occurs. Now, Mars has a comet tail, by the way. NASA finally announced it, admitted it. But it does not have rings. Jupiter has many rings. And you can see on Jupiter, for example, the innermost moon, Io, of Jupiter sports what is called a torus. A torus is a donut-shaped ring, primarily sulfur dioxide, and Io itself is primarily made of sulfur dioxide. Remember that the 21 pieces of a comet called Schumacher-Levy 9 crashed into Jupiter back when was that? Okay, just a little history. Schumacher and Levy were two guys that discovered comets, or were comet discoverers. And so this was the ninth one that they discovered together, thus the name Schumacher-Levy 9. In July of 1992, this comet broke apart into 21 pieces. And then it didn't take long for people to figure out that this thing was going to crash into Jupiter. So in July of 1994, the 21 pieces come like railroad cars into the night side of Jupiter. Now, the cover of my book, Comets, I have a picture of the 21 pieces of comet Schumacher-Levy 9. And so at that time, I was involved with the Russian scientists who were very interested in this because they, at that time, already realized that my work was correct. They knew that comets were not dirty snowballs. They knew that this was a very good chance. They knew that Jupiter, from my work, had a proton-supported capacitor and that these comets would be taken over by the electric field of Jupiter as they came into the field of Jupiter. So the Russians had every instrument that they had trained on Jupiter. And the NASA scientists said, ah, this is just a little snowball. It's going to crash into Jupiter on the far side. And no, by the time Jupiter turns around, there won't be anything to see because these little ice balls will be swallowed up by this massive planet Jupiter and just burrow into the atmosphere and there's nothing to see. Well, the Russians knew better. And so they had every instrument, including X-ray detectors, telescopes, everything they had was pointed at Jupiter when this happened. And the word came back from the Russians, I got it directly, that they said publicly, this is the death of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. Because the energy, okay, understand this, as we're looking at Jupiter, the comets are coming in, 21 pieces of them, boom, 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 in order. And they, first of all, as they came into the realm of Jupiter, they were water comets out in the wider solar system. As soon as they got into that region of Jupiter, they turn into sulfur dioxide comets. And NASA goes, oh, well, they all had sulfur dioxide in the nucleus. No, they all turned into sulfur dioxide comets because they were now in the realm of Jupiter, and that's the primary molecular species. One other proof, 100% proof that my, you know, theory is right, that the comets are attracting the material in the local environment. And so when they hit, the explosions, and these were electrical discharges as they came down to the surface of Jupiter, were so intense that the signature of those electrical discharges and the X-rays given off reflected off of a couple of the moons that were on beyond the far side of Jupiter, reflected that energy back, and the Russians were able to detect that energy as the pieces hit and determined that any one of these was equivalent to more energy than all the nuclear bombs on Earth put together. Not a little snowball, folks. Not a little snowball. And so, anyway, the Russians were just, oh my goodness, this is proof positive of McCanny's work. And they were already teaching it over there in their schools, in their colleges, etc. Many stories about that. But the Schumacher-Levy 9, very, very important comet. But this is an indicative sign that Jupiter is red primarily because of sulfur dioxide in its atmosphere. But the moon Io, this is getting to my point now, the moon Io is the innermost moon. It's highly volcanic. It's a brand new moon. It's very young. It's very hot. And it's attracting this material, the sulfur dioxide, and the material tries to come in, and the moon is moving so fast. Now, I talked about this dealing with Enceladus last week, the comet or the moon Enceladus of Saturn. It moves so fast that as the material is attracted in, the moon has already gone by. So it's eventually getting pulled around in this ring behind the moon, and thus the Taurus. The other thing that's happening is it's discharging the local capacitor of Jupiter and causing an arc. And this is where the ancients talk about the horns of the bull. And this is because a big comet will develop two sunward electrical discharges, one that goes out the top, the northern part, and one comes out the bottom. And at the comet, it looks like the horns of a bull. And I talked about this in my very early work. And that's the ancient references in the Bible, in the biblical text, when they talk about the horns of the bull. That's what they're talking about. Because the comet sports these, and it's got to be a very big comet for us to see it. A really big comet. And so, at any rate, Io is doing that. And it's discharging to Jupiter, not only Io, but so is Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. All four big moons of Jupiter have associated auroral spots that go around the north and southern region of the polar regions of Jupiter. And so there are other rings in the region around Jupiter. Now let's go out to Saturn. Saturn has, okay, most of the rings of Saturn are ice. Well, where does this come from? You have oxygen in the region. You have the hydrogen that's coming out in the basically the proton wind from Saturn's fusion-based atmosphere. And so those combine with the oxygen that's in the region. They form water molecules, and they come back in along the ring line. And so what you see is that they're coming in and actually spiraling inward, like the old record discs. Remember the old plastic record discs where the needle would go around and around and around, and eventually you'd end up with the needle at the center of the record? The same thing happens with the rings of Saturn. And so they're spiraling inwards. And that's proof, too. Also, when this was first discovered, I said, look, these rings are not, there's many, many reasons for understanding the rings of Saturn are not 4.5 billion years old. And so when I was publishing my papers, when I was at Cornell, I got a letter back from one of the editors that said that we know that the rings are 4.5 billion years old. Well, sorry, buddy, wrong. They are very young, and they're constantly moving and changing. But it prompted me to write the paper before any of the spacecraft got to Saturn that I predicted there would be moons in the gaps of Saturn's rings. And I named them, I named all the gaps, and I said exactly how the orbits would be. And I said, there's one moon that's at a skew. It's at an angle, because you only see the fading of the rings in two places. So that told me that that moon was crossing through the ring plane and affecting the fading of the ring of Saturn's rings only in two locations, where the other moons were in the plane and they were affecting the ring edge fading. And the reason I knew this was because from a distance you could see that the moons had to be electrical, first of all, because of the distance. These were maybe 20, 30,000 mile distances where they were affecting the rings, and gravity from that little moon, it might affect them for 20 feet away, not 20,000 miles. So I knew they were electrical. I knew that Saturn had the proton wind, just like Jupiter had already proven that. It was came out in the Voyager data. And so this is where Saturn's rings come from. They're like basically snowballs. They are basically water built up around these icy objects that are in orbit around Saturn. Very simple. And so last week I talked about the moon Enceladus of Saturn. And once again, the moons of Saturn have the arcing, the horns of the bull, arcing electrical discharges. And you can see as they go around Saturn, you can see the auroral spots, north and south pole of Saturn. And those are electrical discharges. And so it's a relatively complex electrical set of electrical currents and current patterns, but it's the same exact process that comets use. So Saturn is a little star. It has a proton wind. It develops a capacitor. The moons discharge that capacitor. They have the arcing horns of the bull, to quote the ancients, horns of the bull arc electrical discharge off to planet Saturn. The aurora points are there. You can see them. It's in the pictures. The NASA data is clear. But yet, they still won't relinquish the idea that space is electrically neutral. I don't know what. Anyway, that's another story. But very interesting. So also, when you get out to the other planets, Uranus and Neptune both have rings also. And we get out to little Pluto in its moon system, and they are acting like Venus, like Mars, and Pluto has a comet tail. And you can see it from a distance. You can see it once you get close to Pluto in the pictures. I have pictures from my paid cast last week, and also on my homepage and on the picture of the day, quite a few places where I show the pictures that NASA took. And Pluto doesn't really have an atmosphere. It's this layer of material that's settling down around Pluto because Pluto is a comet and it's attracting this tail material, plasma discharge comet model. Pluto is one of the Kuiper belt objects, and at a distance, if you could go away from our solar system and look back, you would see thousands of these comet tails out in that Kuiper region, and that's where the Kuiper belt objects come from. They're discovering literally thousands of them. That's why they form. That's why they're forming out there, because that's where the solar wind from the sun holds back this immense cloud of dust and gases, and the solar wind literally pushes it back and holds it there. So if you could go way back from the sun and see our solar system, you would see this vast donut-shaped cloud. And again, that's in my very original work. So the reason I'm going through this whole discussion is to talk about rings and electrical conditions in the solar system. And the rings themselves are proof. The way, when you get up close and personal with them, you see the electrical conditions. You see the electrical conditions in the rings. You see the spokes. You see the discharges running down through the rings, like you took your hand across a harp instrument and you go ring like this. You can see those electrical discharges whisking down through the rings. And the moons, there are dozens of moons. And when you get back and take a picture of Saturn with the disk of Saturn blocking the sun, you see all of these comet tails coming out from the ring system. And NASA says, well, those are just reflected light. No, they're comet tails from the electrical discharge of these moons that are in this region in the ring system around Saturn. Very simple. So at any rate, well, I've got about a minute left here. I just want to encourage you. By the way, the sale is still on my webpage. A couple people have asked me to leave that there. There's 10% off on all of the major water filter products. Remember, I still have 10% and free shipping on all the major water filter products. And I have an extra $30 off on the 10 packs of water filter elements. On the complete survival package, which includes water filters, 10-pack, and both the standard and imperials, and then the Econo packages, which is a filter, either plastic or stainless steel, with two filter elements plus a 10-pack. And so there's those 10% discount, free shipping, plus an extra $30 off those items. So it's really a pretty good deal. And you help yourself out, you help me out, and we both win. We're both winners in this deal. And, you know, get yourself set up to be water independent, something that I really, really feel is necessary. And my water filter elements, I don't want to brag, but I'm going to. There's nothing like them. Everybody else is selling 10-year-old technology. That's the best thing I can say about, there is no competition. My filters all in one. You don't need add-on filters, no priming. That's priming is where you pump the water backwards through the filter to make it work. None of that. Made in the USA in our own factory. Nobody else can say that, I guarantee you. Anyway, lots of good things there. Go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.